On Tech News Today, Amazon announces the Fire TV streaming video service. Apple and Samsung trade barbs in the courtroom. Microsoft jumps into the Internet of Things, and BlackBerry breaks up with T-Mobile. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Chad Johnson.
Jason Howell is off today. Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Brian Fung, a tech reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
So it's a big news day today. Amazon had their big announcement this morning. Microsoft's Build conference is happening as we speak. So, Brian, what do you say we just jump right into the news?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
All right. Well, Amazon finally unveiled its new video streaming hardware called the Amazon Fire TV today. Joining us to explain what they're doing and why they're doing it is Jillian Donfro, a tech writer for Business Insider. Welcome, Jillian.
Hi. Thanks.
So why the heck would an online bookstore, to characterize Amazon in its least flattering light, why would they come out with a streaming TV service?
Well, to categorize Amazon in its most flattering light, it wants to be, well, the everything store and the everything company. So here we have, I don't know if you guys can see it, but this for them is way more than the hardware. Kind of like the Kindle was for their book selection, this is going to be for all their new digital content. So in the presentation that I was just at today, we saw a whole sizzle reel of a lot of the shows that they're releasing for Amazon Prime members, which will be very easy to get from the computer to the TV with this new Fire TV device, as well as the fact that they're releasing a bunch of games, which will be a huge moneymaker for them. They're trying to cover a lot of bases with it, but it seemed pretty cool.
Yeah, it was kind of curious. We did a live coverage of it, Leo Laporte and I, as well as Peter Kafka, sort of covered the live event today. And as we were going through the announcements, it was kind of like, well, that's nothing too exciting. And my first response would normally be, well, they don't know what they're doing. This is kind of a waste of effort. But this is Amazon, and they're really a smart company. They don't jump into hardware businesses lightly. They've only done it once before with the Amazon Kindle line. So they must have something up their sleeve. The price at $99 wasn't super mind-blowing. The feature set didn't seem all that exciting. What do you think that this does, this Fire TV product, do that Apple TV and some of the other competitors can't do?
That they can't do? Well, I think one of the things that they emphasized a lot in their presentation was the speed and just the ease of use for this device. But I think that really it's a good idea for Amazon because of the long-term potential to help them, as I said, like sell their digital product. So if you're already an Amazon fan and you already have a Prime account, it just, $99 isn't too much of a cost that you probably wouldn't want to just buy this. And once you have it and you're seeing all of that Amazon Prime instant video content that you already have, you're set up to start buying more things. And for people who don't already have a Prime account, but want some really easy, intuitive, middle of the range price-wise way to watch their online content on a television, those are the people that I think they're planning on making money on long term.
So, Jillian, let me jump in here. I wanted to ask you, you just said Amazon kind of has its hands in a lot of different pies here with this device. Yeah. Is there like a particular feature that jumps out at you that you find super compelling? And you know, does Amazon run the risk of doing too much at once?
Well, one of the things, as far as risk for doing too much at once, it'll be interesting to see what their games that they're releasing are like, because they talked a lot about their new gaming studio that they're creating, that they're going to be making their own games. And I think that is obviously something that's taking a lot of resources. And maybe the games will be awesome, but that's a risk, like whether those games will actually be something that people feel like spending money on or not when they're released.
Now, the gaming thing was a little bit of a surprise. Even though there was a leaked picture of a gaming controller, I thought, yeah, there's a leaked gaming controller. These companies work on all kinds of experimental prototype things. It'll probably come later if it does come at all. But no, they announced it. It's ready to go right now, yeah. The gaming controller with the games. They talked about how there are going to be lots of games from major companies, including Disney and others. And it occurred to me that they probably are going to allow you to play Android games. Doesn't that seem to make sense? Or will every single game have to be explicitly created for the Amazon Fire TV product?
Yeah, I think that your gut there is correct that you'll be able to play.
It wasn't clear from the announcement, was it?
Yeah, they kind of mentioned something along those lines, but yeah, they rushed from sort of hinting at that to then moving on to some demos. So it wasn't entirely clear, but I wouldn't be surprised since they are running an Android system on the Fire TV. It does make a lot of sense that you'd be able to play the Android games that you have on your phone.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought was really interesting in all this was the fact that they have this currently existing program where if you have kids, you can sign up for all you can eat content, yeah. Which is books, movies, and that sort of thing. And they're extending that to the Fire TV. This has parental controls, and so the parents can decide what sorts of content is available. Then the kids can go in there and just choose their own content. That seemed like a really smart move, and it goes back to your point, which is that this is a great thing for existing Amazon yeah. fans and existing Amazon users. But that sounds to me like a compelling offering to be able to just, instead of just turning your kids loose on regular television with all the right. junk food commercials and all that stuff, you can turn them loose on this thing. They can kind of like entertain themselves and yeah. make their own choices, but it's all controlled by the parents. What do you think about that product? Do you think that's a pretty compelling offering for some people?
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that I thought was really cool is that if you're a kid and you're messing around with it, and you really like dinosaurs, is the example you used. You can even click a dinosaur button for all these different options that they have and just see all these different shows that have dinosaurs in them. And also, again, this leads into Amazon's long-term plan for monetization of this, is that they're also offering, I don't remember their exact name for it, but some sort of unlimited package where if the parent wants to get sort of an Amazon curated list of different shows that Amazon's saying, hey, these are all kids safe and kid friendly, they can also pay a little extra to get that.
Yeah. Well, a couple of the other things that they emphasized in the announcement was the fact that it's search centric, and they said that their search product is very, very good. And that when you search for a movie, for example, it'll show you the movies side by side from the different services that are supported with the prices so that you can choose the cheapest one, presumably. They also emphasize the fact that it's a voice command. So you talk into the remote control, which has a microphone in it, and that'll launch these searches very quickly. So it sounds like a pretty good offering if everything works the way they advertised, if the search function works as well as they say, and the voice thing. That those would be differentiators to a certain extent for now. But I think that eventually we're going to see lots of TV streaming boxes that do all of those things just as well. And this is probably a preemptive play to sort of keep the competitors at bay for people who are already using Amazon Prime. Well, Jillian, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today this morning. And, of course, we're going to have you back tomorrow as our guest co-anchor.
Excited. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on, and we'll see you tomorrow. You can find Jillian's work at businessinsider.com and also on Twitter at Jillian. So let me spell that, JILLIANILES.
Yep. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, in a second, we're going to catch you up on the Apple-Samsung lawsuit. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle is a site that will buy your used gadgets and give you cash money for them, and plenty of it, too. You'll be surprised at how much they'll actually pay for that old device you have sitting around in a drawer. Just go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, and find out what your item is worth. You simply go there, choose your item, indicate what condition it's in. If it's in great condition, you can say that. And then you are given a price. That price is locked in for 30 days. Even if during that 30 days, the value of the device declines, they'll honor the price they showed you initially. They'll pay you fast by check, PayPal, or the best option is 5% more with an Amazon gift card. That's right. They'll give you 5% more money for your device if you choose the Amazon gift card option. And they'll wipe your data for free. So if you left some personal information on the device, they will take care of that for you, so you don't have to worry about your private financial information, whatever, getting out there in the wild. Gazelle has paid more than $100 million to over 700,000 customers. So find out what your Apple or Android device is worth. Take a minute, go to gazelle.com and find out. Do it now because your device may lose value the longer you wait. Well, yesterday was the first day of a shiny new Apple-Samsung lawsuit where the two most profitable handset makers haggle over, you guessed it, patents. Apple and Samsung went straight for the legal jugular in their opening arguments yesterday, with Apple saying that Samsung, quote, crossed to the dark side, Star Wars reference, and blatantly copied the iPhone. Samsung countered by saying that Apple is just trying to limit consumer choice. Now, Brian, this is there's a lot of name-calling and so on, but Apple isn't messing around, and they're also not they're not going to be bought off. This isn't about money for Apple. This is about establishing who controls some of the user interface elements that they are very proud of and claim to have invented. How do you rank the first day? How would you, what's your initial impression of the first day? Do you think that Apple's coming on too strong here, or do they really have a point to be made?
Well, I think, looking at what both Apple and Samsung are arguing, both sides are coming on pretty strong. They each want to make the strongest point that they can in the opening sort of sessions. What does sort of stand out to me is that this is something that's gone on for a while now, this ongoing fight between Apple and Samsung. One thing that hasn't really come up as a sort of result of this is what this kind of holds for consumers. Apple is generally seen as a company that charges gigantic premiums for its products, while Samsung's devices are a little bit more affordable. That raises some interesting questions about the digital divide and who gets access to what devices, moving forward, and what this means for Americans who can't afford a really expensive smartphone versus smartphone that's a little bit more less polished, but just does the same work.
Now, interestingly, four of the five patents that Apple is suing Samsung over, and of course Samsung is also countersuing Apple for two patents, but four of the five that Apple is suing Samsung over are in fact things that are built into Android itself. Now, one school of thought says that you can't really sue Google because they don't charge for Android. This has to be based on damages, and Samsung is making money hand over fist selling these devices. And so Apple is emphasizing that this is a Samsung issue, and Samsung is emphasizing that it's a Google issue, and they keep wanting to drag Google into it. And probably Google's happy to go into the courtroom and testify and basically support Android and Samsung. But it's an interesting difference between this case and previous cases, because these are fundamental user-facing, user interface elements that are built into Android globally. And so, this is really a weird case that Samsung has to argue, which is like, hey, you're suing the wrong guy. You should be suing our partner. Do you think
that's an interesting point? Yeah. I mean, I think that there is something to be said for the way that some of these features were implemented, which show up in Android. At the same time, there are a lot of features that, were implemented first in Android and then wound up in iOS later. Things like push notifications that come down as a badge or a banner, a notification tray that you can slide down from the top of the screen. Those are all things that Android had first. And so, at the end of the day, how productive is it really to say that the right person to go after is Google when there's actually all sorts of cross pollination happening here?
There is, in fact, and of course, these companies become litigious after they've been burned. And Apple's one of them. They felt that iPod intellectual property was stolen from them. And so then when they came back, Steve Jobs, in his 2007 announcement of the iPhone, said, boy, have we patented it. And he pointed out they just went crazy patenting everything in sight, everything that's possibly patentable. And of course, Google has not done that with Android. They haven't been as aggressive in patenting every little thing inside Android. And that's really one of the big differences here is, as you say, there are many things that started out in Android and ended up on iOS. But I think that the balance is really in favor of Apple, in part because they've been so aggressive in actually patenting things that you might not think that would be patentable. But under current patent law, you know, it's and especially where software is concerned, you can patent just about anything. Well, let's go on to another story, because this case is going to drag on for another month or so, and it'll be interesting to see how it comes out. I don't think we're going to cover it too much more until we get to the end, or unless there's some breaking news. We covered it yesterday and today. Probably going to take a break on that story for a little while. So let's get to the next story here. There's a big question that's been brewing lately, and it's becoming a legal necessity to have an answer of this. And that question is Bitcoin money? It's an important question. For example, the IRS says it's property, not currency. And of course, they would say that Bitcoin is property and not currency, because if it's property, they can tax it. And it turns out that Ross Ulbricht, the alleged creator of the Silk Road online black market, agrees with the IRS, according to a new article on Forbes.com by Andrew Greenberg. You see, Silk Road used Bitcoin as a method of payment, and Ulbricht is charged with, among other things, money laundering. He says that if Bitcoin isn't money, then how can there be money laundering? It's an interesting point. With us to explain all of this is Andrew Greenberg himself, and I want to welcome you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
First, can you tell us what Silk Road is briefly, and what is this case all about?
Well, Silk Road was a black market anonymous website that sold essentially any kind of contraband that you can imagine, or rather limited to victimless contraband, things like narcotics and counterfeit documents. And it was a thriving black market business that did something like $1.2 billion of sales before it was shut down in October of last year. And all of these sales happened exclusively in Bitcoin. And then, of course, the site was seized by the FBI, and its owner, allegedly this 29-year-old kid named Ross Ulbricht, was arrested in San Francisco.
Now, do you think the claim that Bitcoin isn't a currency, do you think that's a sound legal strategy? Are they going to get anywhere with that?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, this is just a motion to dismiss all charges. It's not really, the trial hasn't started yet. The trial starts in November. And this is really just the first hint that we've seen of the strategy of Ross Ulbricht's lawyer, Joshua Dreitel, who is a very accomplished defense lawyer who has taken on lots of terrorist cases, in fact, very high-profile, complicated cases. And we can see that he's really, I think he's just trying every argument he can think of. The Bitcoin argument is maybe the most controversial and the one that will have, you know, the most wide-reaching effects for the rest of the Bitcoin economy. It's very clever, you know, following just days after the IRS's announcement that Bitcoin is not currency, that it's property, he's turned around and said, well, if it's not currency, then how can it be used in money laundering? And the court will have to contend with that before it even begins to address the actual prosecutor's accusations about the alleged administrator of this black market site.
So, Andy, if the IRS says that Bitcoin is not money, and federal law enforcement is partly charged with going after money laundering, does that create tension between different agencies with different jurisdictions?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it does seem like this is kind of a problem, in fact, a gap in money laundering regulations, and they will have to probably be changed in some way to include this idea of digital property being used for money laundering. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know all the details of money laundering law, but Joshua Dreitel, the lawyer in this case, cites a New York Law Journal article that pointed out actually 2 months ago that this is a problem for money laundering regulations, and it comes just as New York financial regulators are trying to implement money laundering regulations about Bitcoin. So I think that in the process of creating something like a Bit license, which seems like it's going to come for Bitcoin-based businesses, they're also going to have to potentially amend money laundering laws themselves to deal with this new idea of a digital property or a digital currency that can be used for potential money laundering applications.
Now, Andrew, the Bitcoin question is kind of a little bit on the periphery. The main argument, as I understand it, is similar to the one that Kim.com is using in the Mega Upload case, probably one that Pirate Bay people use, which is this whole question of when you have a platform where things happen that are illegal, is the person who provides the platform liable for that activity? And I think, as I understand it, this is his central case, which is that he just provided the platform and all this drug sales and all that kind of stuff was just happened by users. Is that correct? Now, is that something? Do you think is a good strategy? Is that gonna, you know, do the facts point to that being the case?
Well, it's interesting. The there are actually two different laws. When we're talking about copyright cases like Kim.com's case, that's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has this safe harbor for unintentional infringements of users doing copyright infringing things. And in the case of the Silk Road, Joshua Dreitel is arguing that it should be protected by the Communications Decency Act. Section 230 creates another kind of safe harbor for other, for actual illegal activity that happens on a website, not just copyright infringement, but in this case, something like the sale of cocaine or heroin. And it's true that the Silk Road is not like Amazon. It's much more like eBay. It hosts third-party sellers. So the administrator of the site, if it is Ross Ulbricht, even if he was running the website, that doesn't necessarily follow that he was selling drugs himself. He was kind of facilitating the sale of drugs by other people. And another law that Joshua Dreitel, the lawyer in this case, cites is what's known as the crack house statute, which is a separate drug law that applies to someone who owns a crack house, essentially a place where drugs are used and or manufactured or sold. And it's a different law than someone who possesses drugs or uses drugs or just sells drugs. So he argues, the lawyer in this case, that because the crack house statute exists, that shows that the laws that are currently being used to go after the administrator of the Silk Road don't apply, that they should be using this crack house statute instead, which actually has much smaller penalties, but actually wasn't even used by prosecutors at all in the indictment. So he's sort of pointing to an inconsistency here.
It runs to a theme that the law is not up to date with the realities of today. They're essentially accusing them of money laundering and talking about crack houses, and he's living, everything is virtual. It's Bitcoin,
right,
and
yeah.
It's not a house. It's a, it's a website, so it's all sort of virtual and in the cloud. Well, Andrew, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and giving us your insights into this case.
Well, it was great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You can find Andrew at Forbes.com and also on Twitter at @A_Greenberg. Well, Microsoft's Build Developer Conference starts in San Francisco, and it's going on now. The keynote is still going on. They just switched, according to Ina Fried on Twitter, they just switched sign language interpreters. So it's a grueling ordeal for the people who have to do sign language interpretation. Can you imagine doing sign language interpretation for a developers conference? Must be very difficult. Anyway, it looks like the company gave us an accidental hint about what they'll be announcing, at least in one case. A website was spotted yesterday called windowsondevices.com. It was quickly taken down, but not before a few bloggers got to rifle through its contents. They found a promotional site talking about Microsoft, quote, bringing Windows to a whole new class of small devices. Mentioned things like talking bears, robots, a smart coffee mug, and even the Internet of Things running Windows and powered by Intel's Galileo platform. Sounds pretty cool, actually. The site also talked about a forthcoming SDK and bragged about a life-size piano, which may debut at the Build conference today. Now, Brian, this seems like a kind of obvious move for Microsoft, and they should have been ahead of this whole Internet of Things. They've had embedded versions of Windows for forever, but it's nice to see that they're getting organized with it. It sounds like, and that they're coming out with an SDK, and they're sort of the fact that they're using the Intel solution there indicates that this is going to be for makers and for education applications. So that's pretty cool. The Galileo platform, of course, is an Arduino certified development board that's based on x86. And this is the kind of thing that people who like to tinker with these things can use. Are you optimistic that Microsoft can sort of insert itself into the maker movement, into the Internet of Things activity that's been going on?
Well, as you kind of pointed out just now, Microsoft has a huge history in embedding Windows in devices, from things like ATMs to gas station machines. Windows is present in all of those. And so, what better company, to handle the Internet of Things than, a company whose software is already in many of these things that will someday be connected to the Internet. I think that, one big question is, how open this SDK will be, and how much freedom will it give developers to create and innovate? I think that as more devices get connected to the internet, Microsoft also has big strengths in its new CEO, Satya Nadella, has a big background in cloud computing and cloud services. So, all of those strengths could potentially combine to make Microsoft a really big player in the Internet of Things space.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm ready for a smart coffee mug, but we'll see what they come out with. I'm sure that what we're talking about here, whatever it is, will probably be unveiled today. If not today, then tomorrow. So watch for news on the Internet of Things as it relates to Microsoft today. Well, a website called ramshackleglam.com was stolen from its rightful owner on Saturday. The thief immediately attempted to sell it on an auction website. The buy it now price was set at $30,000. The site's real owner is Jordan Reed, and through a lot of resourcefulness and tenacity, she managed to get her site back. She not only lived to tell her tale on Mashable, but she's here to tell us all the gory details. Welcome, Jordan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
First of all, what is Ramshackle Glam?
Ramshackle Glam is a site I started in March of 2010. It's a lifestyle website. It covers fashion and home decor and parenting and entertaining. And I have a book coming out this week, which made it like a really bad time to have my site go down. I was sort of concerned about that.
I beg to differ. This is no such thing as bad publicity online. So hopefully
exactly the same audience.
Good point. So how was the site stolen? Actually,
I didn't even know the site was stolen. In a sort of a twist of remarkable luck, I got an email from my father, whose colleague had been searching around on this auction site and had just sort of noticed that my site was up for sale. And he emailed me and said, this looks fishy. What's going on? And I immediately looked into it and discovered that I was no longer the owner of my domain name that I had owned and operated for 5 years.
And they were selling not only the domain name, but they were offering the content and even your writing services, weren't they?
Yes, they were. They were offering, I actually found out later that they did have access to everything I had ever written and were going to transfer it to the winner of the auction. And yes, they did offer, they said that I was possibly available for hire to write some posts to maintain the site's traffic.
So in looking into this, did you find out anything about the people who stole your site and what they wanted to do with it? Why would they target you?
Well, what was interesting to me was that they didn't actually email me. You would think they would have tried to extort as much money as possible by going straight to the person who was the site's owner. I think what was going on was that this is obviously a huge business, and they were trying to unload it with as little drama and as little fuss as possible. That didn't end up being the case.
So how did you get it back?
Well, I took a three-prong approach to trying to get it back, and two avenues did not work out, and the third did. First, I tried to deal directly with the registrars. In my case, the registrar that I had owned the site through was HostMonster, and the site had been transferred without my authorization to GoDaddy. Now, neither of these companies would do anything to help because both maintained that the problem was essentially the other companies. And I spent days on the phone and was just greeted with, "Sorry, I can't help you," from everyone I spoke to. They didn't even know how to deal with this situation. I also called the FBI, and the FBI, it's an ongoing investigation, and they have been amazingly responsive and incredibly helpful with this. And then the way that I did end up getting it back was I actually had the friend who had found the listing, who had no visible connection to me, negotiate to purchase the site directly from the seller. And that was what ended up getting us the site back.
And did you actually have to pay for it?
No. What ended up happening was we sort of went back and forth, and then he demanded that the money be sent in advance of him sending the site. So I had no other option than to literally authorize a wire transfer that he could have taken and run and not given me the site. But if I didn't give it to him, he was definitely not giving me the site. So I authorized the wire transfer, and I sat there very nervously trying to see whether I was out thousands of dollars in my website or just thousands of dollars. And then the domain came through, and I immediately placed a stop on the payment.
Brilliant. Well done. So the system for dealing with this kind of theft is clearly broken. How do you think it should be fixed? I mean, what should have happened when hopefully what should have happened is nobody should have stolen your site, but what should have happened once this transfer took place from HostMonster to GoDaddy? What do you think should be the process that takes place?
Well, look, you can't have, you know, a system where anyone can call up and say, hey, you know, there's a domain dispute and immediately get the site frozen. That would create a situation where you get a lot of people trying to sort of falsify this kind of situation. But what should happen is that, A, the employees of these companies should be educated and should know that this is a situation that, you know, ICANN has policies about it. They're supposed to immediately identify a temporary emergency action contact. None of the employees that I spoke to knew about this until I told them about ICANN policy. And the second thing that they should do is, you know, when there is a situation where there is probable cause, where I, you know, you have someone who can prove that they are the owner of this site, the site should be immediately frozen. You know, no one should have to say, oh, I'm guilty of a breach of security in order to have it frozen. It should just be frozen until the dispute is worked out, so that it cannot be transferred or sold or taken down or anything like that.
In the future, what role would the FBI have to play in that process, if any?
You know, I don't know. I think that what would end up changing this process would be legal action against GoDaddy and HostMonster. You know, I think the FBI's job is to track down the guys who did this, not necessarily, you know, chastise GoDaddy and HostMonster and other companies like them.
Is legal action something that you're considering against GoDaddy and HostMonster?
Yeah, I mean, of course it is. I think that in my case, because things turned out, you know, fine, less a little bit of, you know, profound anxiety for a few days, I think that it would need to be, you know, a situation where we brought in other people who had experienced other similar situations and sort of worked together to get these policies changed. Because we're talking about, you know, we're talking about people's lives and people's businesses in a very real way. And you know, I got a little taste of just the extent to which my entire business could have been brought virtually to a standstill by something like this. And that's not a joke, you know?
Well, Jordan, congratulations for getting it back. Sounds like you really outsmarted the crook. And I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, you can find Jordan at ramshackleglam.com and on Twitter at ramshackleglam. We told you on March 5th about a promotion run by T-Mobile that offered $200 to customers to trade in their BlackBerries for a new phone. Any phone. It didn't have to be a new BlackBerry. Something like 94% of the BlackBerry users on T-Mobile who took advantage of the offer moved to a different brand, moved off of BlackBerry, mostly to iPhones, according to a leaked memo. But today, we learned that BlackBerry has now sent a Dear John letter to T-Mobile telling them that BlackBerries will no longer be available to T-Mobile customers after April 25th. So they're essentially breaking up. As Ars Technica pointed out this morning, the change will hardly matter because both BlackBerry and T-Mobile are fourth place in their respective markets. So we're not talking about a whole lot of phones. We're not talking about a whole lot of users. So that is an interesting development. Well, Brian, I want to thank you for coming on and being our guest co-anchor today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I really appreciate having you on. And where can people find your work?
I write for a blog called The Switch at the Washington Post, and you can follow me on Twitter at B_Fung.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, there are lots of ways to subscribe to Tech News Today. Two of them are to go to twit.tv/TNT and just subscribe to our audio or video podcasts. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TechNewsToday. We want to hear from you. Send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Make sure you watch our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. And don't miss Leo Laporte's special Google Plus Hangout with Internet pioneer Vint Cerf. You can see that right here on live.twit.tv, or you can search for the event by searching Google Plus for Twit Hangouts. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you tomorrow.